day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the iPro Date Communications Plan conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Darren Triller. Sir, you may begin.
All right. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to spend some time with us. I figured now that the Yankees are out of the playoffs, we can get back to work on the Dade project and start moving things forward again. Okay, so moving on to the objective slide, or the slide with the picture. Again, the teleconference is conducted in such a way so that you can remain anonymous if you would like to, but I would like to have you again consider perhaps signing one of the disclosure forms that we have posted on the web page. As we move along, I'll discuss later, we're going to be setting up a discussion board on the Internet, and I really think you all have skills and ninja skills that everyone else could benefit from, and I think we could work a lot better as a team on the project if we could get to a point where everyone was identifying themselves. So if you haven't filled out one of those forms yet, please go ahead and contact Susan Ulmer, or go ahead and visit the web page and download one of those forms for us. So that aside, moving on to the overview, what I hope to do today is very quickly go over the data we have to date and discuss some of the next steps for the project. And the second bullet is really the main thrust of today. Really, I want to go over what we've been doing here at iPro for the last 6 weeks or so, developing a communications plan for the Dade project, and we'll get into that in a lot of detail. We'll discuss some of the methods of what I hope to do, go over the timelines again, and then answer any questions that you have. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. The data received today, so far we've received data from 8 plans. There's one of the plans that may be in on the call that is we're still in the process of getting things worked out with, and there's one plan that we're still waiting on that is a newcomer that doesn't have data for us yet, but we hope to get them in the future. So far, we spent a lot of time cleaning each of the data files. Although there are required fields in all those claims that are similar for all of your plans, everyone formats things a little bit differently, so it took quite a bit of time to get all of the separate data files in a similar format that would lend themselves to the analysis. We narrowed it down, the claims, just to the time frame of interest. We narrowed the analysis down to just what we consider to be complete claims, so we excluded things like compounded prescriptions because we weren't always certain that the codes met our needs as far as NDCs. We excluded any claims that looked duplicative, things where we couldn't identify what the drug was by the NDC number, and basically limited the data set to those individuals who met our inclusion criteria, so limiting it to folks who are over 65 and things like that. So moving on to the general Dade stats, so far the data set we have includes about 155,000 unique beneficiaries, and for that first quarter of the calendar year we have about 1.3 million prescription claims, so I'm very happy with the size of the sample we've got. Of those claims, about 18% of them were for fewer than a 30-day supply, and so that would suggest to us that they're just episodic use or perhaps as-needed drugs. That designation may have implications for the intervention because some of these potentially inappropriate drugs, if they're used on a short-term basis, it might be all right. It also may have implications for how we address the physicians, depending on how they're using those drugs. About 71% of the patients had 10 or fewer claims for the quarter, and so those figures are pretty much similar to what we displayed before. Moving on to the next slide. Claims over time. This is kind of interesting. This is the first year of that benefit, and the data we're talking about is from the first calendar quarter. So you can see from this first slide that we're seeing an upward trend in the number of claims. So that's based on our data that we were looking at, and you can see that March is quite a bit higher than January by about 20% or so. Moving on to the next slide. This is a slide that was presented at a QualityNet conference to all 50 QIOs by the Iowa QIO, which is managing the prescription claims data for CMS. And if you look at this graphic, you can see that the volume of claims went up considerably over the first 6 months of this year. So the data set that we have so far is the January, February, March you can tell from this you can tell from this slide that it wasn't until about June that things really plateaued and stabilized. And then recalling all the nonsense that was going on early in the year between enrollments and multiple enrollments and extended enrollment intervals and things like that, we could see that the data for the first 3 to 6 months of this year might be a bit questionable. So moving on to the next slide, what did we see? What did we see in that data based on the indicators that we were looking at? We found that about 1.3% of the claims are for those potentially inappropriate anticholinergic drugs, and that about 7% of the beneficiaries are, in fact, getting one. And when we looked at that subset that had dementia drugs and was receiving an anticholinergic drug, it actually jumped up to about 18%. So once again, we've gone over it before. It looks like the sample of data we have really does support our moving forward on the intervention. Okay. Baseline results by plan. The next slide, there's a bar graph that basically compares all of the participating plans separately, and then the last column is the combined aggregate for all of the participating plans. You'll notice that there are letters assigned to each of the participating plans on the bottom. Those are completely randomly assigned, so they're not, you know, A does not refer to the plan that's first in the alphabet or anything like that. So each of you is embedded in there somewhere. And your individual reports that you should have gotten in the mail already have your letter designation in them. So this slide basically compares all three measures for all the participating plans. As far as the first measure in the light blue, it doesn't look like there's too much variation in the number of claims that are for those inappropriate drugs. They're all in that range, about 1% or so. But as you start looking at the percent of bennies, you can see there does start to be quite a bit of variation amongst the participating plans as far as how many of those patients are on those different drugs. And then when we look at the percent of dementia patients who are getting those anticholinergic drugs, it expands even further, that there does seem to be some of the plans that are about an average, you know, about 15% or 14%, somewhere in there. There are a few that are a bit lower, and there's a couple that are a fair amount above that. So I think this information, I hope it's valuable to you. I know it was valuable to me, that it shows that there might be differences in how the different plans handle these drugs. I want to go in and use this information to go in and look at the differences maybe in your formularies or the processes, or possibly work with you directly to see if your patient mix is a little bit different. But the disparity or the variation among the different plans leads me to believe that as we move forward in the intervention, we may spend more time or direct more attention to the plans that have the higher rates. That said, each of you plans submitted a different number of claims, and to keep it blinded, I didn't include any indication of numbers of prescriptions that each plan submitted, because that might give people insight into which plan is which. So if you take Plan F, for example, that is a percentage of their total claims. That is not a percentage of the total claims we analyzed. So what I'm saying is that some of the plans, even if their bars look lower, they may actually have a large quantity of prescriptions there and may have more beneficiaries that need intervention. So as we look at the individual reports that you get, we'll have to put that in perspective. The percentages are one thing, but the number of beneficiaries affected is another figure that we need to keep in mind. So I think we did a decent job pulling the figures together, and I think this data does give us some ideas as to where we want to go and how we want to proceed. And moving on, what we did do is, based on the fact that early data is from that first part of the benefit year and that we think that things hadn't stabilized too much, I've actually gone ahead and requested of CMS that we use the second 6 months of this year as our true baseline. I think what that will let us do is use a sample of data that that excludes those first few months so that we're getting a better look at what's going on in reality. What we can use that data for, and what I think it is very good for, is for guiding the steps that we're taking to reinforce and reaffirm why we're doing the interventions. But we did ask CMS for our ultimate assessment in 2 years that we use that second 6 months. So moving on to the next slide, the value of that data. I believe it's been very helpful to work the bugs out of transferring the data. It supports the premise that these drugs are still problematic in our patient samples. It does allow us to a certain degree to compare the plans to one another so you get an idea of where you are. And I really feel that that sample of the 155,000 beneficiaries is sufficient to at least guide us. But I want to use the second 6 months of the year as our true baseline now that we've got many of the bugs worked out. So moving on to the next slide. So what have we been doing for the last 6 weeks? This is a very big project, and it involves a large number of beneficiaries, a very large number of prescribers, and across a very large state. So I wanted to make sure that whatever we do makes sense and is ultimately effective. So what I did is I had a couple meetings with our communications department, and we went through a process based on a program that is put out by the CDC called CD Synergy. And it is basically a very methodical process for going through and identifying what you're really trying to accomplish, defining what the problem is you're trying to solve, and it leads you through a number of steps to make sure that whatever intervention plan you come up with is actually on message, is doing what you want it to do, and hopefully puts us in a situation of being as successful as possible. If you're interested in that program, I put the link there, and it's available free, and I think you can get a free CD copy of it as well, because I found it very helpful. Even though I thought we had a very good idea of what we wanted to do, before we jumped into the intervention phase, I thought it was very, very helpful to go through this process. So what I'm going to do is take the next few slides and go over those points and what we came out with, and we can discuss that information at the tail end. So the first thing they had us do was define our problem statements. And what we came up with are these three several bullet points here. Anticholinergic drugs may be inappropriate in the elderly because, as we've mentioned before, they may not be effective. They do have significant toxicities in the elderly, and that there's suitable alternatives that exist. Moving on to the next statement. This is where it started to get interesting because before you develop the intervention, we really had to go through the thought process of identifying why it is a problem, and so we can discover a solution that we think works. And there's problems at multiple levels with this. There's prescriber-based problems. There's a gap in knowledge. The physicians may not necessarily be up on all the information on this topic. We know that there is a lack of physicians with specific geriatric training and that our population's aging, so we're moving into an era where we have a larger number of older patients, but with a physician base that isn't necessarily trained specifically for treating geriatric patients, nor do they have the expertise necessarily in this area of anticholinergic drug use. Unfortunately, physicians in the community may become passive in their learning habits. The requirements for continuing education are variable and can be very lax depending on your discipline. And the system they use in the physician office is very very geared towards treating the problem du jour, not necessarily assessing their seniors in a systematic way each time they're seen. So there's a number of things that go on at the physician level that we think we think contribute to the problem and that we think lend themselves to intervention. Communications is a problem throughout the entire healthcare system, whether it's between the prescribers and the pharmacies, the prescribers and the patient and their pharmacies at multiple levels, communications is a major problem. And so whatever intervention we come up with, we hope is going to help facilitate communication between all the stakeholders. And then at the patient or caregiver level, there is a lack of understanding of the symptoms of toxicity. Many of the symptoms, if you think about it, of anticholinergic drugs are things we often attribute to just old age. So altered vision, impaired memory, constipation, urinary retention, a lot of the symptoms are those things that you expect seeing in the elderly anyway. So what can happen is a patient may not associate those symptoms with a drug they're taking. They'll go to the physician's office who is not thoroughly evaluating them for a number of reasons for anticholinergic toxicity, and they end up adding additional drugs to treat the side effects when the appropriate course of action in many cases might be to discontinue a drug that we think is inappropriate. So all sorts of causes at various levels, and we're going to have to try and be creative and come up with a way of addressing as many of these as we can. So moving onward, the process, the CD Synergy, really made us think through and identify very clearly the behavioral changes we really want to influence. What do we really want to get out of the intervention? The behaviors that we came up with at the prescriber level, basically there are three, and I'll start from the bottom of those bullets going up. The fourth bullet there is, it is not a campaign to eliminate physician choice or complete use of these drugs. So that is not a desired behavior change. That's just a stated fact with this program. I don't think it's realistic to make the physician stop using these drugs or to in any way force their hand. The three points that we really do want to get them to do is to, when they're starting a new patient, to choose drugs that are more appropriate. So that point one would be, don't start your patients on these drugs when there are alternatives available. This might not generate the fastest change in our numbers, but it might be the most feasible because it doesn't involve trying to get a physician to change the medications of a patient who's already on them. So if we can get the message across, don't start them on these drugs if they come in with depression or insomnia or any of these things, I think we'd be doing a very good thing. The next point after don't start is to try and encourage the physicians to assess their geriatric patients on a regular basis for signs and symptoms of anticholinergic toxicity. So for those patients, let's say, that have been on the drug for 10 years and seem to be doing fine, we want them to continue to reassess that patient because as they age and as they start other drugs, they may start to exhibit some of these symptoms, and we don't want them to be in the mode of saying, well, it can't be that drug because they've been on it for 10 years. We want them to continually reassess their patients for these signs and symptoms. And then the third point is to get the physicians to consider adjusting the regimen in cases where they see toxicity. So the points will be, don't start. If you have a patient who is on them, please look out for these things. And if they are exhibiting signs and symptoms, please consider changing. And changing could be reducing a dose or switching to a whole another therapy altogether. Again, we don't want to force the physician's hand because they may be reluctant to embrace the intervention plan. What do we want to do at the public level? For the patients and their caregivers, we want to increase their awareness of these symptoms so that they can start associating some of these symptoms potentially with the drugs they're taking. And we want to then take that information and have them discuss it with their prescriber. So we want to improve the knowledge base of your beneficiaries and provide a process by which they can communicate better with their doctors. And at the pharmacy level, again, we want to educate pharmacists so that they are looking out for these problems in their patients and to facilitate communication with the prescribers and with their own patients. So a long list of things and a lot of work to be done. The next step, the SWOT slide, after identifying our behavioral changes, the process made us really think through what the strengths, the weaknesses, and the opportunities and the threats are to this program actually working. I think our strengths are that there is a growing literature base showing that, indeed, this is not just a good idea to avoid these drugs in patients. There's more and more evidence every day that these drugs actually are harmful in the elderly. I just spoke with a researcher at a major academic institution who shared with me that they just finished a study of inpatients, and they showed definitively that patients who were exposed to anticholinergic drugs in the hospital had longer lengths of stay than patients who did not, even when they adjusted for disease and other risk burdens. So there's a lot of literature out there, and I think there's a lot more geriatricians and neuroscientists and pharmacologists that are starting to study this. So we have more and more literature as we move forward. Other organizations, such as the American Society of Consultant Pharmacists, has developed interventions that have been effective, and they've also developed clinical tools. So we won't have to recreate the wheel. We may be able to modify things that have already been tried and true in other settings. What are our weaknesses? The prescribers that are most likely to use these drugs may be the ones that are the most resistant to change. It may be difficult to compete for their time to educate them on the literature and on the latest information. The public, as I said, is very much unaware of this as an issue. And even if they are aware, a lot of times patients are very much in the mode of, I trust my doctor, I've had them for a long time, I've been on this drug, and they're still uncomfortable with change. And I've seen that many times, that patients, even when they're faced with the information that the drug might be causing a problem, they might still be more scared of a change. So there are some weaknesses there that we're going to need to identify and then work around. Opportunities, I think we have some fantastic opportunities to get a message out. I believe we have support from New York State government and the federal government for doing this. I know the Department of Health has led initiatives and continues to lead initiatives focusing on inappropriate drug use. I believe it's of interest to the professional organizations, pharmacy and medicine. Professional societies may be a great way of getting the message out. And patient caregiver groups, I think groups for seniors, Alzheimer's-focused organizations, all sorts of people, I think, in that sector are going to be interested. And again, the organizations that accredit health systems, such as NCQA and JACO, places like that, they are also interested in this kind of work. So if we can develop a good intervention and work closely with a lot of these groups, I think we'll be set up to succeed. Medicare Part D plans, obviously we've got a lot of support from you folks. And one of the other opportunities is that the Internet is just so useful for getting information out. So I think we have a great communications team here that I think can put together a really high-quality product that will get this message across. So moving onward, the threats, again, resistance to change, immediacy. A lot of times our health system, as I said, is built to fix the problem that a patient is experiencing right now. We don't do a good job of fixing things or preventing things that are not problems at this very moment. Sustainability may be an issue. We know that if you train somebody to do something, if you don't retrain them and keep the message out, competing messages tend to dilute the effect over time. And I don't know if you felt it, but I know people out there are experiencing measure fatigue. You've got numerous organizations telling you what to do, and the prescribers are the same way. They're getting mail, they're getting faxes, they're getting phone calls from everybody under the sun trying to get them to follow some other measure. What I hope to do with this measure and what we're trying to do is to dovetail it as much as possible with NCQA, with other initiatives, so that we're not making things worse. And everybody's got busy. Everyone's got priorities. I know you're staring at November 15th enrollment, and so we're competing for time. So these are real threats and things we're going to have to work around. Moving on to the benefits, very briefly, we really think that for the plans, it's going to improve the product. I think your patients are going to do better, hopefully improve their quality of life, perhaps reduce their overall medical expenditures. And I think more work like this is going to be coming from CMS, more measures, different types of measures. So perhaps by being involved in DADE, this will get your feet wet and get you better prepared to meet those challenges as they come out. I think the prescribers have a lot to gain as far as education, improving the care of their patients, improving their relationships perhaps with you. So all sorts of benefits for the prescribers. And moving on, the patients and the pharmacy as well have a lot to gain. So I think we've gone over these things in a lot of different ways. So I think it's pretty obvious that there are a lot of benefits and we do need to move forward. So on to the plan of attack. This is a slide from 1942, almost this time of year, from World War II, and the idea of saying, where are we at, where are our troops, where are our resources, and where do we plan on going? So I'd like to take a few minutes and go over what we've come up with internally and see what you think. So moving on, those three strategic goals relate back to those behavioral changes that I mentioned earlier. The three-part message is to encourage physicians not to start the drugs, to encourage them to continually assess patients for signs and symptoms of toxicity, and to facilitate successful adjustments in their care, in their drug regimen if those symptoms are there. So that's a three-point communication plan, and you'll see the materials that we build, I think, are going to try and keep hammering those 3 points very clearly. Primary tools, I discussed it briefly before. I see two parts of this as being the keystones to the whole intervention. I want to put together some very high-quality educational offerings for physicians and pharmacists. I'm putting together an expert panel of physicians, PhDs, and pharmacists from around the country and around the state to review whatever it is we put together as far as materials and contribute to the development of these materials. So while I'll have a lot of input into the materials, I want the face that is put on these CE programs and things to be that of actual experts who are recognized in the field. And the educational offerings are going to hammer on those 3 points that we talked about. By using the web, I think we can make it as flexible as possible. The information can be accessible from anywhere that they've got internet access, and it allows us to then, once we have it posted, is to just focus on getting people to visit the site and finish the materials. As far as flexibility is concerned, again, we want to do it in modules so that the actual CE programs are short enough for a physician to do it in a reasonable sitting. And we also are going to put short one-page things that even if they visited the site but don't have time to finish, they could print something off and take it with them. And we also want to have a more expanded slide set so that if they are interested enough in the topic, they can get more information. So we almost want to put it in a small, medium, and large size just to give them the access to the information in the format that best fits them. Once we've educated them, we want to put out clinical tools, again, that are presented and are put together with the input of these clinical experts and these research experts. And what these tools are going to do is try and encourage both the physician and the patient to discuss the signs and symptoms of anticholinergic toxicity and to facilitate and guide the physician through changes. And again, we want to put those tools in a format that lends itself to being in the physician's pocket, to be in the physician's waiting room, perhaps be at the pharmacy counter, perhaps be something that goes out in a newsletter. We want the content to remain the same, but be in a format that lends itself to distribution in a number of ways. And if we can get the educational tools and the clinical tools hammered out and have them be of high quality, the rest of the effort is going to be disseminating it. So once we get the high-quality product together, the rest is just getting the message out. So moving on, promotion of the materials, once they are done, I see it happening in two different ways. The first way would be general promotion. These materials will be available on the Internet to anybody in the world that wants to look at them, so I think it makes sense for us to get the general message out in as many different ways as possible. So for iPro, that would mean using our existing internal email lists and newsletters and other relationships with providers and others in the community to just alert them to the fact that these materials are available. So that may take the form of an ad that we put in all of our Healthy Seniors newsletters. It may take the form of that same notice going out in emails to the medical societies and things like that. From your perspective, that general marketing or the promotion campaign would be like very similar. If you have a newsletter that's going out, we would provide you with boilerplate and some information to put in there that would alert your physicians to go there and your pharmacists and perhaps your beneficiaries. And I think the nice thing about this general promotion plan is that once we have the clinical tools and the educational materials posted on the web, we can start doing this immediately and start getting the general word out. Beyond that general message, we discussed before that we want to use the data we have and the relationships we have to also focus in on those prescribers, those practices, and those beneficiaries that are at high risk, so the high-volume prescribers, the patients that we know are on the combination of the anticholinergic and the dementia drugs. And although I don't have the details of how this is going to happen worked out yet, what I did discuss with the administration is we have approval to hire an individual whose job will be targeting those groups. This person will come on board, will work directly with you to develop a plan that works for your prescribers and your beneficiaries based on your data to target those high-risk groups. So this person will be referred to as a PIC, or a Performance Improvement Coordinator. They're going to work directly with you and perhaps start, like I said, with the high-risk groups, such as the interaction patients. This individual, to a certain degree, will be able to tailor those efforts to your own needs and desires. The educational materials and the clinical tools will stay the same, but how you get the message out, how we approach your doctors, how we approach your beneficiaries, is something we can work out with you at an individual level. Once the person is on board, and those materials are ready, we can commence that. So I'm hoping to have this person hired. The ad should be going out shortly, and hopefully have somebody on board in November and in December at the very latest. What is this person going to be like? Ideally, it'd be somebody with a master's degree, perhaps in nursing or maybe a physician's assistant. I definitely want somebody with primary care office experience so that they know the language and the logistics of how the offices work. So if they were to go do an office visit, they could talk the talk, they would understand the workflow and all those things that are involved at the physician-patient level. Ideally, the pediatric clinical experience, so that they can have a grasp on the importance and on the medical literature and to be able to speak from their own experience when they're interacting with the offices and things. And we want them to be tech-savvy because we want them to be tech-savvy. Moving on, what methods might they use working directly with you? As I said, I'd like them to be able to tailor things to the largest degree possible to meet your own needs. We can discuss using the data and formulating physician report cards that go directly to your own prescribers in a format that you would like or that you can that you agree with. We can use hard mailing, set up teleconferences, perhaps use the expert panelists, those medical experts that we're using on the materials to give teleconferences to meet with the prescribers. Email, web, office detailing if we need it. And if it's feasible. It's a very labor-intensive way of doing things, but it is in the realm of possibilities, especially if we have real outlier physician offices. So moving onward. Promotional materials to the beneficiaries and the caregivers. So far, all I've talked about is getting the education out and the materials out to the prescribers. We talked earlier about sustainability. I think it makes perfect sense to educate the physicians and do a lot of that report card business and physician detailing and calling them. But at some level, we want to make sure that the beneficiaries also become aware of the project. I also think that going to the beneficiaries might be a better way to maintain the sustainability of the project. It's very difficult to go into a physician practice and convince them to change how they do things. Let's say we come up with a clinical tool. It would be very difficult to go into a large practice, convince them to adopt our clinical tools, and then get them to actually incorporate them into their workflow over the long haul. I think that would be very difficult. If we can periodically perhaps put out information to beneficiaries that includes links to the information, perhaps even the clinical tools themselves, in newsletters, putting them at the pharmacy counters, things like that, I think that may add to our sustainability. But I would only pursue this stuff with the beneficiaries after we've done a good job of getting the information out to the prescribers and to the pharmacists so they're not blindsided if a patient comes into their office with a clinical tool or wanting to discuss a topic that the physician's not familiar with. Moving on. Short-term timeline is actually the same as last time. I think we got a little bogged down in getting the reports to you, but now that those are out, I think we're in that interval of developing and implementing the materials. I have a draft of a clinical tool, and I have a draft of some of the educational materials already done, and we right now have invitations going out and are being returned from the clinical experts. So what we're going to do is develop a secure discussion board on the internet that these experts can go in and help us fine-tune these materials. But I believe that the clinical tool and the first educational program is very far along. They're both very far along, and we could have them out very quickly. The timeline long-term is still the same. Data analysis, we got data from you obviously already for the first part of the year. We will still accept data from you at whatever is convenient for you. But the data set that we're really very interested in is the second 6 months of this year, and we told CMS we'd have that data by February. So what I'm planning on doing is hoping that you will get the data to us for the second half of the year as soon as possible as we get in 2007. And then I want you to, if you would, work as closely as possible with the PIC when they come on board to discuss whether you want to submit your data more frequently or not. You might choose to submit your data more frequently if you're in a position where you're developing, where we've decided to develop, let's say, physician report cards, because we would get them to them in a more timely manner. Getting monthly data sets, there'd be less of a lag. If you decide with the PIC that you don't want to do those physician report cards, submitting the data every month doesn't necessarily make sense. So bottom line is data for the year of 2006 will be needed for us in January or so, so that we can report it in February. The decision to submit it more often than that is up to you. So moving on, the to-do list. This first to-do list are things that hopefully you would agree to do as part of the project. Continue to do the data transfer definitely by February of 2007, and to do them more often if you decide that that would help you implement the intervention. And we will work with you in whatever way you want us to. Some of the plan submitted data that isn't inclusive of all the required fields we want, so I'm going to put together a list of required fields for that 2006 data submission. So hopefully you can submit only the all of the required fields. I also would hope that you would comment to me on those individual reports that you received in the mail and your perception of this overall plan. In addition, moving on, I'm going to set up a Jenny, or it's a joint effort in New York. It is a bulletin board that we maintain here at iPro on our webpage. And once I get the expert panel up and running on their board, I hope to set one up for you as well, so that when the materials are almost completed, you'll have an opportunity to go in and comment on them online within a closed forum. I'm hoping that you would contribute to the general promotion of these materials internally through whatever processes you have once we get the materials ready. And I hope that we would please embrace this individual once we hire them so that they can work directly with you to tailor the interventions to your plan. What am I going to do? As I said, I am finishing up assembling this expert panel, discussion board for them, so that they can begin fine-tuning our interventions and our materials. I am going to post documents for review and comment by them and by you on Jenny as soon as possible, and those would include the data fields that we're going to ask for, the specifications, the final specifications for the measures. I have those drafted and would like your final comments, the educational program materials, and the clinical tools, as we discussed. And I promise to hire that PIC as soon as possible to get them targeting the interventions for you. So I've covered a lot of ground, but I think it all comes down to the point that we want to develop high-quality education materials and clinical tools. We want to put them on the web so they're universally accessible. And then I want to have that PIC work with you to tailor the distribution of those materials to your needs, and then to also have kind of a general distribution campaign going on at the same time. At this point, I'd like to open up the line to questions and comments from any of you that are out there.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Okay. Well, it doesn't seem that there are any questions. So what I will do at this point is I'm going to move forward as discussed, and I will be in touch with all of the participating plans very soon regarding the status of that PIC. And I will also be in touch with you with instructions for getting into the bulletin board that I will set up for all of you. I plan on having a brief teleconference on that just to orient you how to use it and how to access it, but I won't schedule that until I know that we absolutely need it so that there's not a lag between setting it up and actually using it. So unless there are any more questions, I'm going to let you get back to your busy day, and I look forward to talking to all of you again soon. And thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Thank you and have a great day.